Blog Talk Radio.
Well, the current battle against the media is a deadly culture war begun long ago before Trump even thought of running for office. It has been for generations that the media is opposed to the broad outlines and values of American culture. To go back through all of the different fighters in this war, including, for example, Dan Rather, who falsified information so that George W. Bush wouldn't get reelected and now is spending the rest of his life in some weird attempt to save his reputation. But you could go from one famous commentator to another, their various work that they did for the liberal cause and attempts to change people's minds, shape opinions of individuals, and to really be able to say that you save the day for socialism, I guess, or liberalism, and to be able to stand up amongst your fellow journalists who are really advocates. Most of them are far left advocates who constantly are eliminating information from news reports and stories that would make the left look worse. And they're shaping, they're crafting the news, and the outcome has been a false narrative for 50 years, I guess, and so at least. And so now Trump is kind of taking this on, and glad it's him. I mean, who else is going to do it? But it's really pretty sad the state the journalism has fallen to. And I've got an example here, of course, but there are countless examples. But you recognize this is one that I played. Now, in any other industry, you said something like this, you wouldn't last a day. Your job is to deliver something, and you admit that you're not trying to deliver that. You're trying to deliver something else, control over people. Here's Mika Brzezinski from Daily Joke.
And the economy worsens, he could have undermined the messaging so much that he can actually control exactly what people think. And that is our job.
Yeah, if you look at the issue, is what I hear from all the Trump supporters that I talk to who were Trump voters and are still Trump supporters. They go, yeah, you guys are going crazy.
Again, one more time here, it's our job. Trump thinks he can control what people believe and think, but that's our job.
And the economy worsens, he could have undermined the messaging so much that he can actually control exactly what people think. And that is our job.
Yeah,
that is our job. So Mika Brzezinski blurts this out because she's not terribly good at what she does. She seems like an amateur, but she is just stating what the media has believed for a long time, that they are the true Americans, that they are the ones who stand up for the values of this nation, and they will attack anybody. They will try to destroy anybody who doesn't go along with that. And frankly, they've been pretty successful at it. And until Trump came up, they didn't have anybody who could really stand up to him. And so it's a new day. Now, where everything is headed, it's impossible to know. But I think the one thing that you can say is that Trump is not backing down. I don't really see Trump getting impeached or removed from office. I mean, I definitely don't see this as the kind of person who quits. And if he doesn't quit, they'd have to be successful at his removal. And how are they going to get him out? I mean, how is everybody going to come? I mean, I know there's a lot of corrupt Republicans out there. And the funny thing is, before Trump showed up, you had people pretending to play roles. And when you boiled it all down, you had two parties full of people at the top who only cared about the party. The party had to live while everybody else died. It reminded me of Detroit when these, I mean, go to Detroit now. It looks like a place that the United States invaded and blew up, you know, bombed, burned down. It looks like a place that had the plague and everybody moved out. But just a few decades ago, it was still a great city of mechanical engineering and it was a great profit center. It was a great place of the development of technology. And the unions refused, even though the car makers of other countries were able to put out a better product much cheaper, these people fought for the union. The union had socialist goals. It had socialist values. And what ended up happening? The car makers in Detroit died. They shut down all the plants because there's no compromise in socialism. So everybody suffered. So anyway, here is a little bit of Donald Trump talking about, I'm a nationalist in a true sense. What is the other side? What does Trump stand for? What does he represent? What are they trying to kill him for? I think one of the problems with dealing with Trump for the left is that he was never clearly conservative when he came into office. So what would they go after him on? They had to build a narrative that he was the next Hitler. So they're trying to impeach him, but Nancy Pelosi turns around and says, he hasn't achieved anything yet. You've done nothing so far. Anyway, here's Trump's take on himself. And this is from MSNBC.
Very, very substantially, and simplify the tax code. We're also going to make taxes between countries much more fair. We're one of the only countries in the world that people can sell their product into us and have no tax, no nothing, and they get rich. And yet, if you want to do business with them, you'll have taxes I've seen as high as 100%. So they sell into us, no problem. We sell into them because we don't sell in because the tax is so high that they don't want us to sell into them. So I know that's always been a point of contention, but to me, it's just fair. It's just fair. It's reciprocal. It's fair. And so we're going to be doing a lot of work on that, and that's becoming a very, very important factor, fairness. Because I believe in free trade. I want so much trade. You know, somebody said, oh, maybe he's a total nationalist, which I am in a true sense. But I want trade. I want great trade between countries. But the word free is very deceiving because it's good for them. It's not good for us. I want fair trade. And if we're going to be taxed, they should be taxed at the same amount, the other countries. And one of two things happen. We're going to make a lot of money, or the other country is going to get rid of its tax. And that's good too, because now the product, like Harley Davidson, I was talking to them.
All right. So one of the things that he's talking about has been a policy that's gone on for decades as well, which is we allow free trade here by definition. Other countries like China, or especially Japan has famously held its markets to be closed through various ways. Some of them are cultural and societal, but many of them are government policy. If, for example, the rice industry or the rice market in Japan has been a cartel, so you couldn't go over there and sell. And so, but I mean, you know, the Japanese government had the wrong policy. Now we've seen years and years of stagnation. But it's always some other country that's trying to do this to us. And because we're such a big market, we succeed. But it would be better for it to be fair. We'll take a break here. I've got 1,000 different topics today. And 523-1450, if you want to call in and add your own. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523-1450. You're listening to KOBE. And do play in some classic songs, classic old songs, and we'll be right back.
How would be to capture me. But you had such persistence, you wore down my resistance. I fell, and it was swell. You're my big and brave and handsome Romeo.
All right, so I've got a little bit of the detritus of the Hollywood, the Oscars debacle, and we know what happened, which was there was a bean counter, a guy from PricewaterhouseCoopers, who was involved in He and his partner, this guy kind of looks like Matt Damon's dad. I guess somebody who's very wealthy, who's in the business community, an accountant and everything, but lives in a $3 million home. Anyway, this guy had this box full of these envelopes, and then on the other side of the stage, there's an identical box. And so anyway, I guess it was he that gave out the wrong envelope. Now, who ultimately made the mistake, it's kind of hard to say, but that guy is being finger pointed as the person who was the most at fault. So, but I read this really hilarious article about you know, Warren Beatty, who is highly celebrated actor and producer, movie director. Some of the blame is on him because he didn't shut it down right there when he read Best Actress. But anyway, here's a little bit from actor Robert Davi giving advice to actors who attack Trump.
It is Hollywood's biggest night, the Oscars, and we're betting it's not really a Fox alert to say that there's going to be, you know, critical comments of Donald Trump and the administration and its agenda at that event. These events always generate that. Actor Robert Davi joins us now from CPAC on any advice for his Hollywood colleagues. What do you tell him, Robert, and what do you expect?
Well, for my Hollywood colleagues, I wrote a piece on it the other day. I tell them to just lighten up right now, Neil. I want to have them invite all the immigrants, all the refugees, all the migrants, all the illegal criminals. I think we should open up the rules for the Academy. It'd be a good idea. Let's just forget the rules. Forget the rules for the studio. Let's open the gates in Bel Air and let people camp out. I think it's time that we really show our hearts in good faith. Why have any boundaries at all? As a matter of fact, I don't even think that the police should be security. The men in blue should be security for the Oscars. And now they cordon off Hollywood Boulevard. So law-abiding citizens can't even go. So they've created a safe zone. The liberal, progressive left's safe zone has become the Hollywood elite. So I don't get it, quite frankly, all the complaining about wanting to have an America that has at least some kind of law and order.
All right, but they're going to do a lot of this stuff. I don't envision them doing the kind of stuff that you just outlined, but is it that, and you don't hear this under, you know, Democratic administrations, or certainly not nearly to the degree, but do they look at it as, look, I've got an audience like no one's business right now. I can't pass this up. What motivates this behavior?
What motivates, you know, I'm not in anyone's skin, Neil, but I have an understanding of Hollywood over the last four decades. I've been in it since 1977. And prior to that, and the culture of Hollywood since the 50s and the 40s and the 60s in terms of social justice and a progressive communist Marxist agenda, which at that time was very vibrant at a certain point, between education and everything else, there is a disconnect between the American blue-collar working-class man and the elite of Hollywood. All the Hollywood stars, myself included, on whatever level of I'm at in the industry, but I can get on a plane and I can work in China. I can go to Europe and work. I can Australia and do a film. But the key grips, the electricians, the dry cleaners, the makeup artists, the electricians, they can't get on a plane. So the industry, the belly of the industry gets gutted out because the elite Hollywood can fly on a plane and they lose touch with that working class guy and the needs of the working class. That's what we've seen, the forgotten man. As I said on your show, November of 2015, I don't know if you remember, Neil, but I got very emotional about it when I said there have been a lot of people that feel ignored in this country. And it wasn't out of anger, but it was out of love. They feel ignored. Now it's called the forgotten man.
Oh, you're right about that. You're right about that. Real quickly, La La Land is up for 14 nominations. You're a gifted singer.
All right, so here's a little bit more from Gingrich. You know, the outrage over Trump. Trump is out of Hollywood. Trump had a very successful show, and he knows those people very well, had his own production company. And I don't know what his you know, reputation was like when he was doing his TV show. And I never saw a show. I didn't sound like a highly complicated concept, but it was very successful. But yeah, I just find this, you want to talk about unsustainability. The left is always talking about sustainability. I find the left's attitude and ideas to be totally unsustainable, because if you were to put all of them out there, like Robert Davey just said, you're 100% in favor of illegal immigrants. Bring them to the Oscars. Let them stay in your house. The criminal illegals that you think shouldn't be thrown out of the country, let them move next door. Let them squat in the empty house next door. You know, and some of them are probably pedophiles, right? I mean, if you're a would you like to live under the tracking system of I don't know if they even do this in Mexico, but I mean, I'm sure people that are being tracked like that and understand that they could just go to America and just live a life where there nobody bothers them and they can do whatever they want. You know, how many people who are pedophiles, for example, convicted pedophiles, came from next door to live here because they were tired of their reputation being ruined. Anyway, here's a little bit from Newt Gingrich.
Reaction. New York Times bestseller, Treason, former Speaker of the House. Fox News contributor Newt Gingrich, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. That was quite an opening.
Well, do you think that, can you give me one award show for nurses, for surgeons that save people's lives, for EMTs, for firemen, policemen, garbage men, construction workers? Where are their award show? I don't see any award shows for them.
Well, I think that's right, but I'll just give you one fact that shows you what a phony Jimmy Kimmel's reasoning was. He talked about 220 countries that don't like us. Those folks in Hollywood make a large part of their profit out of all those countries. And they know that their movies have to sell worldwide. And the fact is, those countries like our movies, and most people in those countries would like to live in the U.S. We don't have a problem of Americans trying to leave to go somewhere else. We have the challenge that all over the world, people want to come to the U.S., admire the U.S., and believe that we are a country that offers great opportunity. And, you know, you can start from there, and the whole rest of that stuff is just baloney.
Do we really have to get lectured? Congratulations to the Iranian that won the award, but do we really need lectures from an Iranian when their country brutalizes women as fourth-class citizens, kills gays and lesbians? All they need to do in Hollywood, go to YouTube and take a look, because the videos are out there. They can look at them chanting death to America, wanting to annihilate Israel. I thought they had a monopoly of compassion for these groups. Apparently not.
No, look, I think you have to start by saying almost nobody in that room is a serious person. They're all actors who act, and they all have a vague, unrealistic sense of the world, and you shouldn't take them seriously. It's like having, you know, a cousin or a brother-in-law who you know is a doofus, and you wouldn't loan him your car, but, you know, he comes by and he watches a ball game with you, and you go, yeah, I understand Herbie. These folks are not serious people. They're very often great actors and actresses. They very often produce very entertaining products. I love movies. I've loved movies my whole life. But you shouldn't take them as though they were serious people, because nothing they do about the real world is serious, except they love money.
That is a good point. And they're not making as much as they used to, and nor are people watching the Academy Awards ones like they used to. You actually had a great comment about fake news, warning about what is a new threat.
All right, so that's him on the Oscars. I think the Oscars were down 10 or 20%. The greatest part of that was that they wanted the whole show to be about how terrible Donald Trump was. And, you know, you've got this what they call monomania in leftism. You get your mind on one thing and you repeat it over and over again like a mantra. Trump is Hitler or whatever. And it ends up being about what a disaster the Oscars were, because when it came time to choose the best film, they got the wrong one. They got all the people on the stage. Oh man, that was funny. So that's all they're talking about. And so these groups that do come together, you know, one of the things about leftism, it doesn't follow religion, it's own religion. But you know, if you're a leftist, you can do anything you want as long as you agree to whatever the latest thing is. Kelly O'Connor, 631, and got tons of stories for you. We'll be right back. 523-1450 on KOBE.
I will never, never know. It's not that you're attractive, but oh, my heart grew active.
All right, 635. What does leftism stand for? If you had to explain to somebody what exactly leftism, liberalism, far leftism stands for, well, I mean, do these people even know? It used to be, I used to hear a lot of people talking about how we needed higher taxes. You don't hear that as much anymore, but it was one of the go-to moves of the left. Obviously, the more money the government takes, the more they can spend. Leftism treats the government as the only authority. That's one of their themes. Other of their themes is, you know, that the basic Marxism, the rich get their money by stealing from the poor, therefore the money has to be redistributed. But, you know, in countries that take on socialism, you don't get it. It never becomes paradise, and I'm sure you've noticed this, but a country that takes on socialism agrees to throw out human rights and a Bill of Rights and a constitution because the government takes all power. and then the people don't become equal in anything except suffering. They don't, you know, that a socialist country, the myth is that it raises all of the poor people up, right? Because you're giving them the money from the rich. And Marxists have a very static view of money. There's one pot of money. And if somebody has money, then they're doing well, they're happy, they're satisfied, they're not fighting, or they're fighting for more. The poor are constantly have their hands out, they're suffering, they're starving, except the poor in this country are obese, but that's another subject. But the upshot on that is that, you know, the application of leftism just creates misery, but the Marxists have a static view of money. It's not dynamic. There's one pile of money. There's only so much money out there. It's got to be redistributed. Now, that is not true economically, because modern economics, market economics, shows that basically, you know, from Adam Smith forward, you can grow an economy, as we've done in this country, and you can get everybody more. That's Ronald Reagan's "A Rising Tide Raises All Boats." But, you know, you've got to remember that these people have a very simplistic view of where money comes from. But so anyway, here's a little clip from Venezuela. Take the ideas of the local people who seem to be to the far left, the Billy Garrett's, the mayor Miyagashima's, all of these people who say this is a no growth area, which is terrifying to hear. You know, a business shuts down with 400 employees, and it is an epic crisis. The shockwaves traveling from one end of the valley to another, because we're a no growth area, we don't have a dynamic economy, right? Anyway, here's a little bit from Venezuela. Crisis so bad they eat dog, cat, and flamingos amid massive food shortages. This is the country with the world's largest supply of petroleum, by the way, and the average person there has lost 14 pounds.
Venezuela's economic crisis has become so bad that people are now eating wild animals they can find. The price of items continues to rise so dramatically, citizens simply can't keep up. Hyperinflation is taking over, and people are suffering. You came here for the truth, so let me unveil that for you. Let's get into this today. Looking at Venezuela, I also want to talk about Greece and some other issues, beginning with this. After suffering months of merciless shortages of food, medicine, Venezuela's now face a new problem as a result of the economy's collapse. They can't even get passports. They need to leave the country. Now talk about a travel ban when they can't even get passports. Venezuela's bankrupt government does not have the money to import the materials and spare parts needed for machines to make the passports, leaving thousands of citizens without the possibility of traveling abroad. And this article here talks about the challenges they are facing right now, specifically with this. You also have the border between Colombia and Venezuela that has been reopened after a year. I covered when they closed. Here we are approximately 1 year later, where they have reopened it. Traveling is definitely a problem here, and it's going to be for the foreseeable future if this continues. I mean, they don't even have enough funds to repair their passport-making machines. This is truly becoming severe, and then you get through an article like this onto this one, and it makes you wonder what the heck is going on. Venezuela's food crisis, which, by the way, to interject, you know, I've shown you the lineups that people have to face, the food rationing. It's become truly something that will go down in the history books. Venezuela's food crisis has gotten so bad that people are apparently killing pink flamingos and other protected animals in order to stave off hunger. Look, people do desperate.
All right. In this article that he's referring to, they're also talking about taking pets, dogs and cats, donkeys, even giant anteaters have been found in garbage bags at city dumps around the country. Why? Because these people, the government can't produce its own food. Why can't it produce it? Because you bring in laws that stop competition between the government and the private sector. You make it illegal. You make capitalism illegal. You've got a whole army of workers to work on the economy, to come up with new ideas, innovations, breakthroughs, to come up with some business to meet a need in the community. You make that illegal. And then the government is supposed to be filled with all of these geniuses. And then the geniuses are, I mean, they're not, no, there's what they call a command economy is what they have in these places. The government tries to foresee, because what the government is fighting against is profit, because they've bought into Marx's idea that it is profits cause wars. It is wealth and the separation between different classes of people, the rich, the poor, the middle class, that causes wars, that causes suffering. Now, don't pay attention to the fact that the communists created the greatest war machines in history. Fascism in Hitler's Germany and in Mussolini's Italy was highly beholden to Marxism for their theories. They were officially socialist countries, national socialism, Nazi. That's what Nazi means, national socialism. And then you've got the communism of USSR and China, creating the greatest military threats in world history. And but that, you know, they're following Marx here. Marx saying that if you just get what Marx wanted to do was create a paradise by getting rid of property, which you say was crazy. It's insane. Yeah. Marx has probably had a lot of, you know, demons. You know what I'm saying? But the theory itself, when applied, never works out. Now, you see this country that has more wealth from petroleum than any other country, and yet they are suffering. The average person there is losing weight, pounds a month, because there's no food. So you use the law to oppress the people by not allowing them to use their natural creativity and ambition. In Marxism, ambition is bad, right? Unless you're ambitious to take over the whole country and deny everybody their rights, and then you're a god. Here's a little bit more from Visual Politik on why is Venezuela a catastrophe from January 26th. And the only reason I keep harping on Venezuela is because Venezuela is an application of the ideas of the Billy Garrett's and the Mayor Miyagashima's. They take their ideas and they apply them to the nth degree.
While watching this video from Syria, it's fair to say that no matter how bad the situation in your country, Venezuela is doing worse. As of 2015, they are experiencing more inflation than any other country in the entire world. Furthermore, their capital, Caracas, is currently ranked as being the world's most violent city, beating out other famously violent cities in both Mexico and Colombia. Something as simple as buying toilet paper has also become practically impossible in Venezuela, and scarcity has become a norm in supermarkets. Other products, such as condoms, have to be bought and sold on the black market. And all of this is happening in a country with the world's largest oil reserves. In fact, it wasn't so long ago that Venezuela was the richest country in the whole of South America. But today, over half their population lives in poverty. So the big question is, how did they end up there? How did the government destroy the economy in such a short amount of time? Today, we're going to tell you that story.
All right, let's take a little break here. But just to bear in mind that ideas have consequences. And when you hear crazy things like the people voted on the bus system two or three times and they rejected it, but we need a bus system. And then you bring in the bus system and nobody rides the buses, even though it's $1 million a year in a very, very poor, city, poor county. How what do you attribute that to? That kind of like blind leadership, holier than thou, self-righteous. I know better than you do. Sit down, shut up. The voters don't mean anything. My vision is what, I've fallen in love with the idea of mass transit because the people that I hung out with in college all talked about mass transit and the left because the people need mass transit. Where does that leadership come from? It comes from leftism and its failure incarnate. And none of these people, do you think Billy Garrett or Wayne Hancock is going to stand up and say I was wrong or apologize? Don't hold your breath, friends. We'll take a break here and be right back. 647 Kelly O'Connell Show, AMLS Cruises, AM 1450, 523 1450.
Variant Revolution.
The first character in our story is Hugo Chavez, the father of modern-day Venezuela, or should we say the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. He became president after a landslide victory in 1999. His campaign was based on the promise of equality and poverty reduction, a policy that he called 21st century socialism. One of his first policies was called the System for the Democratization of Jobs. This was meant to be implemented in the PDVSA, the state company that extracts Venezuela's oil. And don't forget now that we're talking about a country that has bigger oil reserves than Saudi Arabia.
PDVSA's payroll has more than doubled to 115,000 employees since Chavez took office in 1999, and debt has risen tenfold since 2006 to $34 billion.
This was pretty big news considering the PDVSA is the largest company in South America. Nevertheless, Venezuela kept producing the same number of barrels per year. This means that the staff increase had nothing to do with corporate reasons.
Hey, it's Kelly.
Yeah, you got your Venezuela recording playing over the ads.
Oh, sorry. It's probably an improvement, but I do appreciate that. Sorry.
Yeah, it sounds pretty bad at this end.
Sorry about
okay,
that.
Bye.
Bye. I was informed I was playing the Venezuela clip over the ads. I do apologize. I don't know what I was thinking. Here's a little story. Fourth quarter GDP left at 1.9% despite et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Obama's last quarter, 1.9%. That is a mirror of his time in office. How did that happen? Was it an accident? Was it his fault? It was his design. Watch all of the stuff that Trump does to change the economy to understand the things that Obama put in there. In, for example, vast regulations to slow down economic growth. Here's a little bit more on Venezuela.
We're going to tell you that story.
The Bolivarian Revolution.
The first character in our story is Hugo Chavez, the father of modern-day Venezuela, or should we say the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. He became president after a landslide victory in 1999. His campaign was based on the promise of equality and poverty reduction, a policy that he called 21st century socialism. One of his first policies was called the System for the Democratization of Jobs. This was meant to be implemented in the PDVSA, the state company that extracts Venezuela's oil. And don't forget now that we're talking about a country that has bigger oil reserves than Saudi Arabia.
PDVSA's payroll has more than doubled to 115,000 employees since Chavez took office in 1999, and debt has risen tenfold since 2006 to $34 billion.
This was pretty big news considering the PDVSA is the largest company in South America. Nevertheless, Venezuela kept producing the same number of barrels per year. This means that the staff increase had nothing to do with corporate reasons, but rather political ones. In fact, this job democratization was a way to employ all of the unemployed Venezuelans. The same thing happened in the government. During the Chavez administration, public spending tripled. This meant more government workers and more social programs than ever before. However, none of this was a problem as long as the oil exports kept paying the bills. In fact, Chavez cut poverty in half. Despite being an oil-rich country before Chavez, 60% of the population lived in poverty. 10 years after Chavez, only 30% did. Despite Chavez's rhetoric that capitalist countries were trying to destroy the revolution, no one would reject Venezuela's oil. Even Nicolas Sarkozy, France's conservative president of the time, was complimenting Venezuela's democracy.
I'm glad about Venezuelan elections. With their strong turnout, that shows, once again, the vitality of democracy in Venezuela.
To all of these policies, we must add the famous
expropiese, señor alcalde, expropiese.
This literally means expropriate this. Expropriation being the taking away of private property from its owner. Chavez was no fan of private businesses, and it was not uncommon for him to visit a city and go around declaring that various businesses be nationalized. This would include all sorts of businesses, including things like small shops. All of this ended up with Venezuela having an economy that was fully dependent on its oil. By 2012, Brent barrels were 95% of Venezuela's exports. We should also note here that PDVSA had higher costs than any other oil company, and this was largely because of the staff increases. Nonetheless, as long as the oil price remained high enough to cover the production costs, Venezuela kept making oil and everyone was happy. But just hold on a minute, because this is where things turn sour. In 2014, oil prices fell and Venezuela was the first country to feel the effects of this fall. Their profit per barrel shrank more and more every single day.
Nicolas Maduro f***ed it all up.
Now, by the time the oil crisis started, Hugo Chavez had already passed away, and his successor was a guy named Nicolas Maduro.
You whistle, I whistle. The bird looked at me funny, then flew over my head, and I could feel the spirit of Chavez blessing.
No, this is not a joke, nor is it a quote taken out of context. Maduro found himself the head of a country that wasn't making enough money from its only export, and Maduro had wages to pay. Then, on top of all this, we have the famous... Now, because of all that expropriating that was going on, we've been left with a Venezuela that has no private companies. So even if he decided to raise taxes, there's no one left to pay them. And this is when Maduro made the most irresponsible decision that any political leader can make. He decided to print money. Having devalued the Venezuelan currency, the Bolívar, inflation skyrocketed. Here's an example of how bad this was. Imagine you're sitting in a bar in Caracas in July of 2016. A beer might cost you around 50 bolivars. Then you go back to the same bar in Caracas in September, and that same beer would cost you 100 bolivars. This has been happening in Venezuela consistently for the last 3 years. Obviously, this had the effect of destroying all of the poverty reduction measures that Chavez had implemented. Oh, and believe me, it gets worse from here. Just when things were looking really terrible, Maduro decided to demonstrate just how much worse they can get.
No instrumento legal.
The new tool to finish with the price increases will be the creation of the maximum sales price.
All right, so anyway, It's always the same. There's the belief in the utopia. There's the implementation of the utopia, and there's the collapse of the country. It always follows the same trail, and yet Billy Garrett and his buddies are just infatuated with that. We'll be right back after a break on the air. I've got a lot more stories.
I've got a crush on you, sweetie pie, all the day and night time. Hear me sigh, I never had.
All right, so we talked last hour about a few different things, but one of which was the failure of Obama. Well, pardon me, the failure of Venezuela. But, I mean, you can apply it here, too. There's a reason that there was 8 years of growth that was under 2%. Now, the problem with that, number one, you need 3% growth just to tread water. And to replace jobs, to create new jobs for people that are coming in. So 3% is basically, you've got to aim at 3% just to keep the economy afloat. And so what has happened since the Great Recession started in 2007, 2008, whatever it was, is that we lost an enormous amount of wealth in the country, losing jobs or losing traction in terms of making gains in their employment, in their pay, had to fall back on their resources. So trillions of dollars in resources have been wiped out. In addition to that, you know, with the economy not growing, it's really kind of a lost generation. Now, that either happened by accident or on purpose. My argument it's on purpose, because what is Obama doing right now? He's engaged in the largest sabotage by a former president on a sitting president that we've ever seen. And the media is really not even mentioning it. He goes out and he wins sales in Hawaii with his you know, billionaire buddies. Why, if this guy's a real socialist, why is he hanging around billionaires? Because Marxists believe that rich people steal from the poor, so why is he hanging around them? So there's no end to the hypocrisy in the left, in far leftism. But you know, you have the hallmarks, you have the foundation of a failed economy when you have a one market economy. For example, you build your country on the oil market. What happens, though, which is great if you've got the most oil in the world, what happens if the market tanks? Well, what happens is what's happening in Venezuela right now. But they would have had problems anyway, because they, you know, they did this expropriation. They took the oil industry, all of the trillions of dollars that were invested by foreign national companies into the oil market in Venezuela. Foreign companies developed the oil market in Venezuela. So as when it was developed, then Chavez comes along and says the government owns that. I mean, by what logic, by what law does the government just suddenly say we own all this? I mean, that's theft, right? So you build your economy on theft, and you take in all of the businesses. And so the people that run the businesses are no longer the owners. And so if you don't have skin in a game, there's no profit motive. So anyway, so the foundation for failure is all there, and it's the direction that we were headed nationally. And in one of the hallmarks of leftism is the suffocation under red tape. And so one of the things that Trump is trying to do is get rid of all of the red tape, or enough of the red tape to make a difference. But you know, it's always the same thing. I mean, leftism doesn't have an original thought in its head, but it always turns out the same. Now, switching topics, illegal immigration down by 27% Here's a little story from Fox News on the people, though, continuing to pour over the border in hopes of getting in before some change is made. And this is from Fox, as I say. And got it for you right here.
Hi, I'm Lauren Green, and you're in the Strategy Room. Last week, the Department of Homeland Security released a memo detailing new immigration guidelines. Included in the memo are some of the first details regarding the proposed wall on the southern border and a plan to add 5,000 new border agents. However, three former officials at the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol are saying these increases may present logistical challenges. Here to discuss are Brad Bauman, partner at the Castrum Group, and Frank McCarthy, vice president at the Keelan Group. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Okay, Kevin, let me start with you because these former agents had some words of warning. They told Reuters that the increase in agents will be expensive and the rapid hiring might actually cause corruption if screening is too lax. So what's your response to that?
Well, shocker, President Trump is going to come through on the promises that candidate Trump had made. Listen, the American people want to see the border secure, and this is one of the campaign promises that he has kept. And when it comes to these boots on the ground issues, I always like to get hear from the people that have the boots on the ground. And the border agents, the union members themselves, they are endorsing this proposal. They've said that they need more folks to help secure our border. I'm going to take it from them that they need it, and I'm thanking President Trump that he's given it to them.
Okay, so Brad, if the officials are saying no to a wall and now questioning hiring more agents, more border agents, how do you propose securing the southern border?
Well, shocker, the American people do want to see the southern border that is protected and that is secured. And shocker, Donald Trump is actually making it less secure by taking what Republicans like to throw at Democrats on and say he's throwing money at the problem. Guess what? There is nothing that Trump has done over the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks, that has made us in any way, shape, or form safer or has secured our border. In fact, all he's actually done is create crisis in our immigration system by rewriting and redoing long-held practices that have made it more difficult to ensure that we're weeding out bad people that are trying to get into this country.
Because weeding out bad people is a terrible thing, Brad. We don't
No.
Do that.
Guess what? He's made it harder for us to weed out those bad people, Frank, and you know it. That's why we've been seeing chaos at airports and chaos on the border.
It's a chaos at airports because we see a bunch of left-wing radicals who have to jump out at everything that Trump does and
that's
anything.
Ridiculous.
And I hope they.
All right, so here is the numbers for you. Illegal immigration dropped by 27% in January. Okay, why is it down? It's down because, much like business, people who are going from one country to another want to know what the future is like and will invest in that, to use the business metaphor. People are not going to invest their lives in a situation where they don't know what the future holds, and especially if they feel like they're just going to be immediately deported. So the standards and the practices have changed. From the Washington Times, illegal immigration across the southwest border plummeted in January compared to December as the flow of both illegal immigrant families and children traveling alone dried up, according to numbers released by Customs and Border Protection on Monday. The numbers are still high compared to past years. In fact, it's worse than 2012, but total apprehensions of migrants trying to sneak across the border fell 27% to 31,000. Now, I was thinking about this the other day. All right, so let me ask you this. Do you think that it is wrong? Let's just say you're living in a country next door. One country is poor on the border of a rich country, number one. Number two, one country is safe. The other country is very unsafe. One country has not a lot of opportunities for the poor. The other country has a lot of opportunities. Do you think it is wrong for people in that poor country to come across to the rich country? Now, I'm sure you would say it's fine if you follow the law, do you think it's wrong for these people who might not have the means to go through, arguably they may not have the means to go through the proper method, the proper channels? Do you think it's wrong? is it wrong? If you were living in Mexico and you snuck into America, would you consider that an illegal activity? Maybe not. Do you consider it, it is by definition illegal according to the law, but do you think it's immoral, unethical? Just asking. Let's take a break here, 523-1450. And I've got, how about an entertaining clip on, because we talked about tranny town yesterday and this massive wave of trannyism across America. Is it possible this enthusiasm and the laws being changed for transgenders and all the enthusiasm and the teaching and all these things is taking a group of people that by definition, according to statistics, suffer a great deal of mental health issues? Is it possible that America is making a mistake by backing policies that increase the number of people that are lured into or decide to experiment with transgenderism, and that we're creating a new mental health crisis through that? 523-1450. Feel free to call in. We'll be right back.
That I could fall with so much emotion.
So we're being presented with this idea, as I think society is always does, presents its ideas, its innovations as breathtaking, as mind-blowing as these the way forward, sometimes more true than others. You know, I'm sure the people that came up with democracy or rule of law, constitutionalism, were pretty pleased with themselves. But the transgender fixation, is it a mirage? Is there such a thing as transgenderism? Here's a little analysis on that. An interview between Tucker Carlson, who's probably the best interviewer I have ever heard at getting down to the root of the issues that they're talking about. Check this out. Tucker Carlson versus tranny activist. Is it fair to ask what it means to be a woman or a man? We talked yesterday about this girl who took male hormones. She still competes. She's transitioning. And she went into the female wrestling championship of Texas and won it. She's on male hormones. Did that give her an unfair advantage? Of course it did. But is that unfair? So what does it mean to be a male or female? Check it out.
2 days ago, the Trump administration retracted an Obama-era guideline that claimed the 45-year-old Title IX law required all public schools to let transgender students use the bathroom and the locker room of their choice. The White House says bathroom issues are properly a concern for state and local governments, a position that is getting the administration absolutely savaged on the left. Jillian Weiss is executive director of the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund. After the guidelines retraction, Weiss denounced the administration's states' rights position as nonsense. Jillian Weiss joins us now. Jillian, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So I believe, for whatever it's worth, in politeness and decency and not making people uncomfortable, especially children. I have four. But I also believe in honesty, and so I just want to get to what exactly this means. So I'm a 47-year-old man. I think that's pretty obvious. If I were to decide tomorrow that I was a 47-year-old woman, should I be allowed to go shower in a women's locker room?
The idea that there's no objective factors to be considered in who is transgender and how we determine bathroom use is really not the way that this works. The
okay.
fact is that people make this decision after a lot of serious consideration. They see medical doctors, there is psychologists involved. There's a lot to think about. It's not an easy process. As someone who's gone through that,
right.
I can tell you, you just don't decide tomorrow. So
okay,
that's really not the way it works.
But what if I did decide tomorrow? Should I be? And it was totally sincere. Or by the way, how would you know whether it was sincere or not, or anyone know? Only I can make that decision. And what if I did? I be allowed to go and shower in a women's locker room? And if not, why not?
Well, I think the answer is no. And for example, we have the Gavin Grimm case, which, as you know, is coming up to the Supreme Court very soon. The ACLU just put out its brief in that case. And, you know, they went through what he had to address. He changed his name. He had medical doctors. He had letters from psychologists and so on. It wasn't the kind of thing where he just came in and said, oh, Now I'm going to be using the boys' room. So
okay, so but let's go through just, I mean, because there's a lot at stake here, and you know this because you do it for a living. There's a lot of money at stake, and there's a lot bigger issues at stake, the definition of gender itself, which is at the center of any society. So what are the absolute standards that are required for a person to change his or her sex?
There is an organization called the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, which has a series of standards of care. We're on number 7 now, or 8 is coming up. And so this is something that doctors and medical people, psychologists have worked with for years, and there is a whole protocol. So, I mean, I can't give you the entire thing right now, but I think it's important to understand that there is something called transgender, and we have been here forever. We've been going to the bathroom forever.
Oh, but I'm not contesting any of any of that. And just to be totally clear, I'm not attacking anyone.
Yes.
But I think it's fair, because so much is at stake, to get much more precise than you are getting. So what exactly are the standards? And are they legal standards? Or are they standards that you agree with? I mean, what exactly are the actual standards? Because, again, a lot of money is at stake here.
Yes. Well, the medical standards require seeing a therapist for a certain period of time before cross-sex hormones will be prescribed, a certain amount of time living as the opposite sex before certain kinds of medical treatment and surgery will be permitted. The other thing to keep in mind is that the courts have been parsing this for the last 15, 20 years. And so if somebody is being stereotyped because of their sex, because they're not perceived to fit in with appropriate masculinity or femininity because of whatever people perceive as their birth sex, that is something that's prohibited by the anti-discrimination statute.
Right. So that's the anti-discrimination statute, but you still haven't explained, I've asked you a bunch, what the legal standards are, because I don't think that there are any, and here's why that's a concern. So the federal government spends over $11 billion every year on sex-specific programs, and I'm sure you know what they are. The Small Business Administration, among many others, gives a ton of money to people because they are women. And so how are we supposed to navigate that if there, and let's be honest with each other, there are no standards actually, other than I say that I'm of a different sex. How is it to navigate this, and what's going to prevent charlatans from jumping in and taking all that cash?
Well, let me give you an example. In the field of athletics, there are standards that have been developed for when someone is permitted to move into a particular single-sex activity. It involves how long they've been on hormones, how long their transition has been, you know, whether or not they have the strength equivalent to, you know, that, like women's sports, for example. So there are standards that have been developed. Now, I don't know all of the details of that exactly, but you're asking, for example, how do we...
There is no absolute standard that's been developed, as you know. I mean, look, this is your job. You know that there actually, that's not true. There isn't. The WNBA doesn't have the same standard as the Olympics, as Notre Dame women's field hockey. I mean, there is no absolute standard.
Well, if that's what you're saying, is there an absolute standard? You're correct.
Yeah.
There is not an absolute standard. We are working this out as a society. It doesn't mean put transgender people back in the closet or tell transgender youth, just, you know, fend for yourself.
But nobody's suggesting that, at least on this show. What I'm suggesting is an adult look at this issue. And yet whenever you bring it up, like, what does this really mean? And can you actually change your sex biologically? You're denounced as, you know, it's like a hater. And I'm just speaking for myself when I say that has nothing to do with it. I think it's fair to ask these questions. And so when are we going to find out exactly what it means to be a woman or a man?
Let me just suggest this. I have a list here of 25 studies that have been done over the last 15 years by scientists, peer-reviewed journals, discussing exactly what it means to be transgender, when someone is transitioning, the difference in the basal ganglia of the striatum terminalis, the neuron density in the brain, and so on. I'm sorry for being very technical. The point is there are biological differences.
Let me ask you this. Can you ascertain a person's sex with a blood test throughout life, from birth until death, and will that result remain consistent?
No, not with a blood test.
All right, so there is no standard for these people. Now, I've got a little clip here. Let's take a break, but I got a clip by a guy who had a sex change, and he was, to say the least, not happy with the outcome. Now, you know, these people are, this guy looks like, it looks like he's 250 pounds, wearing glasses, you know, librarian glasses and a blonde wig. about 45 years old, maybe. And that the person that was just talking, let's come back. I got this clip for you. You're going to find it interesting. There is very little mental health preparation that is given to some of these people. The society is so enthusiastic about transgenderism. A little kid says, I'm not a boy, I'm a girl. In the old days, the parents would say, don't be silly, you know, go eat your vegetables. Today, it's become this giant industry of catering to these kids and getting them ready to change genders. We're talking about little kids that don't know anything about life, who are telling their parents they're actually the other gender, and the parents are saying, oh my God, oh, holy cow, let's get the hormones ready. We'll be right back. 728 AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450. Got a little local news for you.
Could you care for cunning calling? We could share.
Guy, I had run into his book and read his book. I thought it was pretty interesting. This guy, Walt Heyer. This is the whole story right here. Check this out. This guy looks like he's 65, 70 years old now, but check this out. And from YouTube, a guy by the name of Michael Corrin, who is, I think, Australian, interviewing him.
Transgendered, transsexual, sex change, and so on and so on. The whole issue is, well, soaked in propaganda. So we thought we'd speak to someone who was directly and personally involved. Walt Heyer joins me now from Los Angeles. Welcome to you.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm well. Let's begin, but please tell us your story.
Well, as a young child, I had a grandmother who apparently I gave some impression to her that I should be a female, or I wanted to be a female. And so my grandmother at the young age of 5, 6, or 7 made me a purple chiffon evening dress. And I was on the journey to changing genders for the next 35 years. And, you know, what I found out is that this struggle with gender issues, people just do not understand that they really evolve out of psychological or psychiatric issues. The gender issue is only a symptom of something of a much deeper problem within children, like it was with me. And I had been suffering actually from a dissociative disorder because of some sexual abuse that I had suffered, from physical abuse that I had suffered, and it came out in a way that was wanting to escape the gender I was in. So I eventually had the gender surgery at age 42 and lived as a female, Laura Jensen, for about 8 years until I realized that, the gender surgery, first off, not one person has ever actually changed their gender as a result of the surgery. You have to be sort of cooperating with the madness to assume a different gender. The surgery does not change your gender. And I think that's important to understand. It's a cosmetic procedure. It does not change your gender at all.
Now, my heart goes out to you because what your grandmother did initially, it was so irresponsible, if not abusive. But what you're saying now, I guarantee you after people see this, there'll be complaints to human rights commissions in this country. We're not apparently allowed in broadcasting to even use this sort of language. Someone is what they say they are, and to refer to someone as a he if they claim to be a she, you can be punished for this in Canadian broadcasting. Can we have a debate about these issues? Are we allowed to anymore?
You know, we really should be allowed to tell the truth. And the truth is that people who are presenting a different gender are really not a different gender at all. It's just total madness. And I think what's happened is that political correctness is now cooperating with the madness. and people aren't getting the psychological treatment and psychological evaluations that they need. And especially with children, such as we see Dr. Spack, who at the Boston Children's Hospital is giving hormone blockers to children. And he claims that he started this procedure because of a Dutch study. And in my book, Paper Genders, I started to write about the Dutch study. And the Dutch study says you really shouldn't be doing these hormone blockers on young kids, that 61% of the people who present gender issues are actually suffering from mood disorders or identity disorders or dissociative disorders or psychiatric disorders. And what's happened now is the political correctness prevents people from actually going to a psychologist or a psychiatrist and getting the treatment they need so that they can actually avoid doing surgery or changing genders.
This is fascinating, because I've seen this in Canada, and I wanted to ask you about the US and perhaps the rest of the world. So if someone goes to a psychiatrist and says, I feel that I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, I've heard psychiatrists in Canada say to me, if we say that this is a disorder and we can help you with it, we could actually lose our license. If there was a complaint made, we could be in severe trouble. Is that true in the States too?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is where, you know, Kinsey many years ago started this whole process of just being crazy with gender and being crazy with homosexuality. And today it's just kind of taken over. And so people who need good psychiatric and psychological treatment cannot get it because they're taking these evaluations out of the DSM, the manual that allows the psychologist or psychiatrist to evaluate people. I had what they said was a dissociative disorder, and they said I had 13 different personalities. Now, that was only discovered because I was working as a technician, chemical technician in a psychiatric hospital, and the psychiatric doctor noticed things in my behavior that caused him to raise questions about my having multiple personalities. So it was only a result of working in a psychiatric hospital that I was able to be evaluated properly and then to be treated properly and then to be able to return to my birth gender. And I get letters from people frequently who are returning to their birth gender. The people are going from male to female and back to male again because the surgery does not resolve the psychiatric issues that people suffer from, and the advocates won't let you get the treatment that you need so that you can avoid surgery.
You know, we have to address this again because we haven't got any time left. Will you come back on the show?
Oh, I'd be happy to do so. I'd love to.
Okay, we'll have you back on.
Interesting guy. I mean, he really seems like he's suffered a lot, but you know, one of the stories that I had read, I'd run into was, I couldn't help but laughing, is this guy had had this sex change, or I can't remember if they had transitioned yet. They'd had the full, you know, from the waist down surgery. But I think he was on, he'd gone onto this regimen of female hormones and decided to stop. And somebody asked him, why'd you stop? And he said, because he had these inexplicable mood swings. And he would not accept them. And I thought that was entertaining. Anyway, Kelly O'Connell, maybe it's just me, 523-1450, 805-6180 to text, although I don't know where my little text buddy is today. I'll bring that tomorrow. We'll come back. Yeah, I got a little local weather for you. I've got one last little clip here. John Piper is a very well-established reform pastor taking on the topic, in case you're curious. Is it okay to be a Christian and transgendered? Now, after this, I've got some analysis for you on the oil markets and on shale that I think you're going to find interesting. So just hang in there. We'll be right back after this clip, and I've got some oil news for you. And here's John Piper.
My father is transgendered, but believes himself to be a Christian. He claims he is exercising his freedom in Christ. How can I honor my father and mother in this situation? Well, I've never been in a situation like that or have dealt with anybody in that situation. And I suppose transgendered could mean my father had an operation to make himself a woman, or my father is simply living out as a woman, dressing like a woman, taking hormones to be more shaped like a woman or whatever. And he claims to be living, exercising his freedom in Christ. There are many issues we face today that are not directly addressed in the Bible, because the Bible was at a certain time and place where such things might not have been done, and therefore they weren't addressed. So you have to look for principles. You have to look for directions. God loves male and female. He made us male and female, and he delights in it. Anything in our culture that confuses male and female is going to probably lead away from the value that God put upon that difference and that distinction. So that would be one way to think about why what he's doing is unbiblical, because that's what he needs to be persuaded of, is that, Daddy, when you do this, you call into question the beauty of the distinctions God has made. Now, he may reject that. And a second angle would be when it says in 1 Corinthians 13, it says, love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. Love is not arrogant or rude. Now, that word rude means, translated in the King James, does not behave itself unseemly. So there is a category of behavior in the Christian life which doesn't have a sentence in the book that says transgendering is a sin. Rather, there's a category that says, is it fitting? Is it becoming? Is it helpful? Is it coherent with all the other things that the Bible says? And I would simply say that kind of use of your sexuality is is out of step with what is seemly for a Christian. One other thing I want to say. Probably whenever that happens, it's an evidence of something else going on in the soul that you should probe for. A craving, a need, something that's over the top, powerful at the spiritual, psychological level that isn't being dealt with and needs to be dealt with.
Anyway, the thing that I would be concerned with if I was doing public policy on this, you know, if I was involved in the government, is it doesn't seem to be any serious investigation into the mental health issues that are involved with these people, other than it's well known that the attempted suicide rate with transgender people is very high. I think it's 41%. That's something that this Walt Heyer guy had mentioned, and I started to study it and found that it comes under the category, I think, of what is called body dysmorphia, dissatisfaction with your body. But, you know, some people become obsessed with amputation and for some reason want to get their leg or their arm amputated, and they say, I won't feel whole, ironically, until I get my leg or my arm amputated. And there are doctors out there, some few doctors that'll do that, but it is considered to be malpractice. So why wouldn't, in the same way, because it's a mental health issue, there's no problem with the limb, why wouldn't it be considered malpractice to amputate someone's genitals for the same reason? I don't get that. But anyway, let me get into the oil sector a little bit. I got some really incredible news for you. U.S. set to rival Russia in oil and natural gas exports. And this is in part because Trump has promised to roll back federal regulations to help U.S. oil and natural gas and to open up new areas for development, according to an article in Forbes, and unleashed $50 trillion in untapped shale oil and natural gas reserves. All right. So Russia had topped Saudi Arabia as the world's largest oil exporter. Now, could we top Russia? Well, there's news out there for you. And Seeking Alpha website says that we're reaching parity in North America to where we may become energy independent within a few years within North America. Now, so OPEC cuts their production, but the price does, you know, the price gets adjusted. But the interesting thing is that because of the shale revolution, there's a lot more flexibility to create outside of OPEC. So just say this right here. In total, the U.S. exported almost 6 million barrels per day of oil last week. And the U.S. has become the third largest petroleum exporting country in the world and outside of OPEC. All right, here is another article. American interest: shale is reshaping America's oil trade balance. And I found this one to be pretty fascinating, too. U.S. oil production has a pivotal role to play in the world oil markets. The shale revolution was the chief reason behind this. Now, Bloomberg is reporting exports are surging to a 24-year high. And we're talking about energy security, and it's all due to fracking. Now, Bloomberg is reporting with shale oil production like this, who needs Trump? Even outside of his rollbacks on market control and the opening up land for drilling, the second coming of shale could be, according to this article, could be even more powerful than the first, and OPEC is getting caught unaware. The current boom in U.S. oil production is even stronger now than in the run from July 2011 to 2015, and this is with prices half their previous level. And so you're talking about an extraordinary burst of oil production, and the U.S. turning into oil nation with, according to CNBC, record exports eating OPEC's market share up. And we could become, it sounds like, the number one oil exporter in the world. We'll take one more break here. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450, and great news for this state, which, like Venezuela, is highly and over dependent on oil. We'll be right back. I want to give a shout out to all the hardworking probation officers out there. I talked to one yesterday who I'm on a friendly term with that tries to listen to the show. And he says, going out of town, it's a little bit hard to hear the show. But anyway, thanks for all the work you do. And undoubtedly, an uncelebrated line of work, probation officer. Here's Jeff Allen, Roaster Chicken.
Heated arguments that are the end of the world when you're married the first early on. 3 months into our marriage, we got into our first really, really, really big fight over a roaster chicken. Only married people would fight over a tiny little greasy bird. I'd gone to take a nap. You know, I learned early on in my marriage, naps were a big no-no. I mean, really. God forbid I'm rested. It's a lot harder to manipulate a well-rested, rational-thinking human, you know. So much easier to get more compliant when his eyes are burning out of his skull. I've learned to sleep standing up like a horse. I really have. We'll be in the mall, and I'll be sound asleep just standing there while she hangs things on me. So I'd gone to take a nap. Don't know if I was asleep 5 minutes or 5 hours. All I know is I'm waking up to the sound of a vacuum cleaner in my bedroom. I'm sleeping, and Tammy's vacuuming the bedroom. Apparently, I wasn't waking up quick enough. She started to go under the bed. We had a water bed. There was no under the bed. I'm kind of rocking on the high seas and not waking up yet, so she goes after something on the pillow and got my hair caught in it. Now I'm awake. To this day, that was 25 years ago, to this day, her reaction still surprises me. Oh, you're awake. And then she says, good, the chicken's done. Well, you'll have to back up. I missed something. She said, no, you said if I cooked the chicken, you'd carve it for me. Then I said the dumbest thing a married man could say to his wife. I looked her in the eye and said, I never said that. If you're a newlywed in this room, trust me when I tell you this. If your wife said you said it, you said it. Don't even go down that road. That is a long, dark, lonely road with no end to it. It just keeps going. Yes, you did. You sat in that kitchen. That's not what I said. It's exactly what you said. No, I didn't. What I said was, I'm going to take a nap. If I'm awake when your chicken's done, I'll carve it for you. I didn't tell you to come in here with a vacuum attachment and suck my brain out of my skull while I'm sleeping. Wake me up so I can carve your chicken. I will pause here while you all choose a team. Because there's a difference. I'll tell you how dumb and naive I was at this point in my marriage. I thought I was done with this discussion. I made my point. I rolled over. I turned my back on my wife. She got on the bed with both knees. Get up. You said you carved a chicken. I said, I carved a chicken. I said, I don't know how to carve a chicken. I never carved a chicken in my entire life. Why don't you carve it? You can mutilate that bird as easily as I could. She said, I don't know how to carve a chicken either. Now, you said you carved a chicken. Get out there. Carved a chicken. You're not going to make the seat. You carved a chicken. You hear what I said? What is this about? I just want to sleep. All right, I'll carve that stupid bird. Now, I'm not even married 3 months. I'm walking down the hall. I'm already a mumbling idiot. I don't even like chicken. You want chicken? You go to Kentucky Fried Chicken, for God's sake. They cut it up for you. What'd you say? I didn't say nothing to you, woman. Now I'm in the kitchen, not in a good mood. I can tell you that. Not in a good mood. Got this little greasy bird. I got a knife. I got a fork. In comes my wife, who just told me she didn't know how to carve a chicken. Well, apparently there was a chicken carving class somewhere between our bedroom and the kitchen. Because everybody in this building knows what happened next. Two hands come out of nowhere. You're doing it all wrong. Let me show you how to do it. You got to do it this way. So I stab the bird with the fork, and I'm waving it at her. Oh, yeah, I'll show you how to carve a chicken. And she grabs my wrist. Give me the bird. Oh, you're not getting this bird. I'm going to show you how to carve a chicken. Give me the bird. No, you're not getting the bird. Give me the bird. Give me the bird. And then she finally says, oh, go back to sleep. Yeah, I'll sleep like a baby now. What, are you going to run a jackhammer next? Give me that bird. I yank. And the bird flies off the fork, starts spinning in the air. It's like in a movie, slow motion. Lands right on her head. Hits the floor, and the grease comes running down it. She goes, oh, I can't believe you just threw it at me. Throw it at you? Yes, you did. I go, I did not. 2 minutes later, she's on the phone with her father. Daddy, come pick me up. He's an animal. That was 25 years ago. To this day, she'll tell people at parties. You know, people go, well, you know, people we don't know. We'll be at a fundraiser or something. They'll go, no, what's your husband do? Well, he's a comedian. Oh, that must be interesting. Well, he has his moment. Tried to kill me once with a roaster chicken. In her version of the story, I whipped it at her skull at 100 miles an hour. A leg could have broke off that bird, went right through her temple. She wouldn't be there now. In a good night, she can wiggle a tear out of one of her eyes, and they pat her little hand as she records the horror of the whole night. You poor thing. I know.
All right, Jeff Allen there. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you have a great day. AM Las Cruces on KOBE, Kelly O'Connell, ciao. We'll see you back in 22 hours.
Could you care for a cunning cottage? We could share.